From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's Actors Day on this edition of Fresh Air. Coming up, we listen with John Lithgow to clips from his films, including The World According to Garp and Terms of Endearment, and we find out how he prepares for his roles. Also, we meet the actor who played Captain Frank Farrillo on Hill Street Blues. Hill Street fans will recognize Daniel J. Travanti's voice, but they may be surprised by just about everything else they learn about him. And we have reviews of a new four-record retrospective of guitarist Eric Clapton and the film White Mischief. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Actor John Lithgow made his movie breakthrough wearing nail polish, eyelashes, prosthetic breasts, and support hose. His portrayal of the transsexual in The World According to Garp earned him his first Academy Award nomination. Lithgow is one of today's most versatile stage and screen actors. You probably also remember his performances as the panicked airline passenger in Twilight Zone the movie, the shy banker in Terms of Endearment, the psychopathic murderer in Blowout, and the fundamentalist preacher in Footloose. Today, Lithgow is back on the stage, where he got his start. He's starring in the Broadway hit M. Butterfly. It's based on the true story of a French diplomat's bizarre 20-year affair with a Beijing opera diva, an affair that ended in sexual and political betrayal. I spoke with John Lithgow from the NPR Bureau in New York about his movie career, but first I asked him to describe his role in M. Butterfly.
I play a character called René Gallimard, who's a French diplomat. The form of the play, I begin the play sitting in prison, convicted for treason, and I sort of spin the tale for the audience. I tell the story of myself 20 years earlier when I was posted in Peking in the French embassy and fell in love with a Peking opera star, singer, and carried on a 20-year-long liaison with her, not knowing, number one, that she was a spy, and number two, that she was a man. That's this kind of astounding premise to this play. And I'm an embittered old man, but I tell the story of myself as a sort of foolish, innocent young man. So, in a way, it's two characters.
As the actor in this role, do you have to convince yourself that there's a way that this character could have had this mistress and not known that the she was really a man?
Well, I sort of have to do that as an actor, but David Huang, the playwright, has answered a lot of those questions. It sounds like a completely impossible premise, and I suppose it is, but watching the play has its own plausibility. As you proceed along, you just buy in more and more to this extraordinary deception. That was my response to the play, reading it, and I think that's the response to the audience seeing it. They can't believe that they're going along with it, and yet they do.
You know, throughout your career, you've acted on the stage. You've done a lot of movies and television, but you keep going back to the stage, and that's also where you started. I think there's a certain thrill that audiences get when they see an actor who they know from the movies, and I wonder if you've been experiencing that now that you're so much better known than you were when you started in the theater.
Oh, yeah, very much so. That's one of the good things about doing films. It gives you such clout on stage. I mean, I remember that myself when I was much younger. I remember seeing Alec Guinness on stage in Dylan and Richard Burton playing Hamlet. There is just an extraordinary feeling to being in the same building with somebody that you've seen on screen. It's pretty rudimentary stuff, but God knows I take advantage of it.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to talk about some of the roles that really first got you noticed in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe play some clips from a few of them and talk about what you did to prepare for them. Would that be okay?
That's fine.
Good. Let's start with the role that I think people really, really noticed you for, and that's in The World According to Garp, when you played the transsexual who had been a linebacker and then through surgery became a woman, and Roberta Muldoon was the character's name. Let's hear a clip from that movie.
You can stay.
No, I have to go have a heartbreak in Manhattan. He's young, he's handsome. Oh, what can I do?
Maybe this time it'll work out.
Maybe so. I'm a hopeless romantic in a male chauvinist world. Bye, darlings.
What were, that's a really great scene, great performance. What were some of the gender questions you had to think about playing a man who had become a woman?
Well, I suppose I had to imagine myself going through all that. Playing Roberta, everybody's always figured that this was the hardest thing I'd ever done. In fact, it was one of the easiest. Roberta Muldoon is, I always approach the character as a very simple and ordinary person who, in fact, was more at home with herself than she had been before her sex change operation. I decided on the basis of not really much research, but just thinking about it, that if I myself were to change myself into a woman, I wouldn't be all that different. There's a big difference between transsexuals and transvestites. Transvestites are crazy about all the affectations of femininity, but transsexuals are very down to earth. They're very ordinary. They're not that different from the way they were before. Just a little more contented. At least that was my approach to Roberta. I had done a lot of unwitting research years before. I'd just been kind of captivated by Jan Morris.
The writer and transsexual.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Had seen her interviewed quite often, had read her memoir, Conundrum, which really recorded the whole process of undergoing this change and all her thoughts before and afterwards. So just inadvertently, I knew a lot about this issue. It came in handy when I screen tested with George Roy Hill, because the screen test was nothing more than a conversation on the subject of my history in the character of Roberta Muldoon.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You once said that playing this character was like conducting a prolonged illicit affair with yourself. That's pretty funny.
Well, it was a sexy experience for sure. I don't know, I was in drag for 3 months, and it's a very provocative experience. I recommend it to everyone.
Why?
It just sort of expands your consciousness. What can I tell you? It was very exciting. You felt like a spy behind enemy lines. I hung out with women all the time, and I felt very secret, like this secret heterosexual, a fox among the pigeons.
You know, another thing I find very interesting about this role is that, you know, you're a very tall man, and the character is a former football player, but the character is very emotionally vulnerable. Now, I think in our culture we associate physical strength with emotional strength, and you had to have physical strength but emotional vulnerability in the role.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was this blend of male and female. I think that's true. George himself, the director, had a lot of qualms about casting me in the role because I was so big. And I always thought that was my greatest asset in the role. It sort of was automatically hilarious and moving all at the same time.
Let's go on to another role. My guest is actor John Lithgow. And I'm sure you also remember him in the movie anthology of The Twilight Zone, where he played a passenger on a plane who was terrified, absolutely terrified of flying. And here he is on a plane that's trapped in a storm. He looks out the window, and he thinks he sees a little monster on the wing putting out one of the engines. A pilot comes and tries to calm him down.
Either calm down, or we're going to handcuff you.
Listen, there's something wrong with this airplane. I don't care what happens to me, but if somebody doesn't do something about it, we're all going to die. That's D-I-E, die!
You big silly! You used to be a normal person!
Silly. Sit down, darling. Come on, okay?
Valentine, what do you think's wrong with this aircraft?
There's an engine out.
Which one?
The one on the outside. Outboard number one. It's out, isn't it?
What did you think about to get that out of control, to get that panicky?
This is great. I got to see these movies again.
I had so much fun watching them all again.
Well, I haven't seen them in years. I just sort of worked myself into a state physically. It was a very intense, like, 10-day shoot. So day to day, I was my voice was all raw and I was a physical wreck. And I just kind of exploited that. My research for this part, it was sort of twofold. I have a very good friend, another actor who is very afraid of flying, and I always knew that, but I'd never known the details of it. And I phoned him long distance in New York and just asked him to talk about it and answered questions. And he told me the most extraordinary things, almost all of which I managed to physicalize and put into that performance. Just as an example, he said, in an airplane, he's very conscious as he walks down the aisle when it's up in the air, not to put too much weight on one side or the other, because he's afraid he'll flip the plane over, which sounds hilarious to us. And he knows it's absurd, but yet he walks like a tightrope down that aisle. And if you see the movie again, that's just how I chose to walk. And there was also a remarkable woman who teaches flight attendants, and she was there as a consultant all the time. And everything I did, I would ask her, am I going too far? And she said, never, never, never. She said, this is nothing to what I have seen.
You know, watching your performance in that film again really made me think about what a very plastic face you have. You can really just totally manipulate your face.
I do have a plastic face, as a matter of fact. No, not really.
No, well, but you can make your eyes pop. You can do things with your cheeks. And,
well, everybody can. I'm the only one who has the nerve.
I want to ask you one other thing about the Twilight Zone movie. In one of the episodes that you weren't in and that you had nothing to do with, there was a terrible accident that we all remember. Vic Morrow and two children were killed in a helicopter bombing accident. Did that really shake you up? Not only the deaths, the tragic deaths of these people, but really like knowing that making make-believe can have tragic real-life consequences.
Well, it was awful, and it was always like a shadow cast over that whole project, even though it was virtually a separate film that happened 2 months before we worked on it.
Oh, that was before your...
Oh, long before, yeah. They were even considering scrapping the whole project, but then they picked it all up again with an entirely new crew. But, you know, we never quite forgot that this terrible thing had happened. I tell you, movie making is so astoundingly dangerous. This is just the most prominent instance, but it just happens all the time. Somehow, something kicks in. You think you're invulnerable when you start acting. It's happened to me all the time on stage. I've really damaged myself over and over again.
What kind of risks have you taken on stage?
Oh, just leaping around. I've twisted my ankle. I've cut my thumb open. This sort of crazy kinetic energy kicks in. And I think it happens with directors, too. They are moving pieces around, and their adrenaline is pumping. They're seeing nothing but the drama of it, and they just hurl things forward. That's why, you know, stuntmen, safety organizations, things like that, they're so incredibly important, because it's like unleashing all these unmanageable emotions and actions and machines. It was only a matter of time before something really notorious and obvious happened. But bad things are happening all the time, and you know, very close, near misses, even though there's a very heightened consciousness because of that accident.
Yeah.
Still terrible risks are taken.
So has it made you more cautious as an actor?
No.
You still have to feel invulnerable to really put out.
Well, it's not that you have to. You just do. Yeah, once you start acting, it's like you don't give a thought to anything. I don't know if you've seen M. Butterfly, but I hurl myself down this ramp at one point, and I can't quite believe I do that every night. But when the moment comes, I just, bam, go ahead and do it.
Are you wearing padding or anything?
I look like a hockey player underneath my clothes. Yes.
I want to play another role that helped make you famous, and this
Great.
Is from...
Great, this is a lot of fun.
Now, this is from Terms of Endearment, where you played a bank officer who's very shy and very straight, and he's beginning an affair with the character played by Deborah Winger.
Emma, I haven't made love to a woman in almost 3 years.
How come?
My wife has a disc problem, and she can't take having any weight on her.
Sam, I hope you don't mind me asking you this, but have you ever thought of your wife getting on top?
Oh, she wouldn't do that.
She may surprise you.
No, I don't think so. It would be so unlike her.
Did you ask?
About 600 times.
That's a great scene. I love the way you speak in that scene. You have this very quiet and unsure speaking style in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a very slight, I don't know, Midwestern accent?
Yeah. Well, he was supposed to be a Hawkeye, you know, and I'm a Buckeye, so I just sort of looked back into my past.
Was it easy to kind of get that insecurity?
Oh, effortless in my case.
Not a big stretch, huh?
No. It was an interesting experience because I was really hurled into it. It was a case of recasting. They called me in, you know, like with a day's notice. I learned my words for that part on a jet plane, a private Paramount jet flying out to Nebraska in the middle of the night. And, you know, 12 hours later, I was playing the part with Deborah. There was absolutely no preparation, so insecurity was part of the bargain.
Oh, so you mean in this role, the insecurity was especially evident.
Yeah.
You know, you also in that performance captured the gratitude that this character would feel for Deborah Winger, allowing herself to have this affair with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was an interesting way of interpreting it.
Well, it's all there in the writing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's beautifully written that way. I mean, that was indeed my approach. I listening to it just now, this is such a memory lane for me. But that scene is so hilarious and so touching all at the same
time. It is very touching, that's right.
And I think that's Jim Brooks' particular genius, but it's also the kind of acting that I'm very fond of, where at any given moment a scene can just sort of tip one way or the other.
Well, but see, that I think that really is part of your gift in Twilight Zone too. I mean, you're really panicking watching this character panicking, but it's also funny.
Yeah, that's right.
But you really play it both ways.
And that's the charge, is finding that little moment where you can pull the string one way or the other, make them laugh in the middle of panic or cry in the middle of laughter, you know. Just surprise them.
Now, I just want to play a short excerpt from your latest movie. This is the latest movie that was released, Harry and the Hendersons.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about a family who takes a camping trip, and they've accidentally killed what appears to be the Bigfoot. And they take him home thinking that he's dead, and they want to kind of show the evidence of what had happened. But he comes to life, so your character calls the police.
Mm-hmm. Look, I hit a Bigfoot with my car. I thought it was dead. I was going to call in the morning, but he must have been hungry because I found it in the kitchen.
Hit a Bigfoot with
no!
your car?
Yes.
In your kitchen.
Look, I'm under a lot of stress here. I mean, what was it anymore? I must have just walked into the kitchen. It was eating out of our refrigerator. I thought it was going to eat me, but it ate my daughter's corsage instead. And then I passed it for you, and then it ate our goldfish.
And where is it now, Mr. Henderson?
It's in the bathroom.
Was it any coincidence that you, I forget how many children you've had recently.
So do I.
But was it any coincidence that you were doing a family film at a time when your family had grown?
That was very much a factor in wanting to do the movie. I've done a couple of things with my kids in mind. They're very blasé about it.
Sure, right.
They can take it or leave it, but I give them 3 months of my life. You know, the Santa Claus movie and the Twilight Zone. Harry and I even did one of Shelley Duvall's fairy tale theater pieces. It's fun, but it's hard work. You have to take it very seriously, doing family entertainment or kids entertainment.
Yeah, sure. Well, I want to talk with you more about your acting and about your life, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is actor John Lithgow, who's now starring on Broadway in M. Butterfly. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Lithgow is my guest. You know, I think it's fair to say that one of the things that you're best known and most respected for is your versatility, your ability to take on such a wide range of roles, as we've just heard in the clips. that we've played. Is that something that you've planned, or is that something that's kind of happened through what you've decided to accept and what you've decided to reject in the roles you've been offered?
Well, I think the latter. I think it's really a result of my background in the theater. I mean, I grew up, the first acting I ever did was working for my dad, who was a producer of regional theater, mostly the classics and mostly Shakespeare festivals out in Ohio. And I worked with him. I would apprentice summers and play all the kind of utility character parts in Shakespeare plays. I never played anything big.
I like the utility parts.
That's right. Well, it was, you know, things like Froth and Nim and Pinch and Hortensio and the Second Musician, all these kind of throwaway parts that have to be, that are usually played by skinny teenage kids. But I mean, my great thrill was every week doing a new makeup and a new accent and stretching myself in different directions. And my first few years as a professional in the theater was working at places like the McCarter Theater in Princeton for my dad, or Long Wharf. A new play every week, or a new play every month. Always, the fun of it was always, let me be as different this time as I can be. And in a way, my movie career and my theater career has just been an extension of that. You don't get that opportunity in the films very often. And the fact that my sort of breakthrough performances in the film were in such quick succession and so very different, that sort of liberated me. And it's made people think of me this way. I feel very lucky.
I read an article that you wrote for Film Comment, and you said something that I really love that I'd like to just quote here. You said, acting is such intense and emotionally involving work that you cannot do it well without thinking that you're working on something great and important, and that's why actors are so often deluded about the worth of a project. Do you feel that you've ever fooled yourself in the middle of a role?
Constantly.
Really?
Constantly, yeah. You, not only do you fool yourself, but you have terrible doubts. You fool yourself both ways. Sometimes you fool yourself into thinking you're terrible just when you're doing your best work. It's, self-doubt and sort of arrogance, you sort of swing wildly between the two, even on the same project. So, and you're almost always wrong about how it'll turn out.
Well, if you've deluded yourself about the worth of a project, would you want a friend to come in and say, John, this movie just isn't going to be any good?
No. Right. I want nothing but praise. actors know what I'm talking about.
Because if you don't get praise, you become insecure and can't function well?
I don't know. I guess I'm talking in terms of theater, where people come backstage right after you've performed, and about 20 hours before you have to do the same thing again. It's almost a conventional wisdom among actors. You find something positive to say when you come backstage, because, I don't know, you're just so frail. Even the most secure and cocksure actor is ready to believe the worst about himself or what people think of him.
You know, you were mentioning your father, who headed up several theater groups, including the McCarter Theater Company in Princeton. And your mother, I think, had been an actress, a retired actress. So I imagine there were lots of theater people around your house when you were growing up. Theater people are frequently more theatrical in real life than other people are. Just everything's just a little bigger than it would be for other people. And for some people, for some people who aren't in theater, that becomes really overbearing and hard to deal with. Mm-hmm. How did you react to being surrounded by theater people when you were a kid? Did you like that?
Oh, I loved it. Mm-hmm. I loved actors, and many of them I still work with and see and I have the same affection for them. I must say, I think because I grew up in that atmosphere, I was infatuated with the theater, but I didn't want to join in. I certainly knew an awful lot of embittered people in the theater, people who would get drunk at a cast party and say, "You don't want to get into this business," you know. I experienced quite a lot of that, and they were right to discourage me. I was going to be an artist. I wanted to somehow or other withstand the blandishments of theater, but I think it was my destiny. I went off to college and started doing college theatricals and quickly realized this was the thing I did best.
Well, after going to, I think, the Harvard Drama School, you went to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't go to, there is no Harvard Drama School. I just went to
you
Harvard.
You just went to Harvard, okay, and studied drama there.
No,
studied painting
no, I,
there.
No, studied English history and literature.
Ah, okay.
Don't ask me why.
And don't quiz me on anything.
Right, God forbid.
When you went to London, were you, did you get a very classical training there?
Very. I went, Lambda has this wonderful one-year program called the D Group, which is for overseas students, most of them Americans. And it's like a sort of, it's like a very intense, condensed British academic acting education. And I sort of swallowed it whole. That and also seeing a lot of theater. I was there at a time when wonderful things were happening in British theater. And it was just, I came back, and as soon as I got rid of my unlooked-for British accent, I was fine.
It seems to me that a lot of roles that you've gotten are the kinds of roles that wouldn't be offered the kind of the kind of actors who look like models. Do you know who have that, mm-hmm. that kind of the perfect good looks of whatever the period is?
Yeah.
Have you ever wanted those kinds of, like, perfect looks? Or do you think that that's really been a good break in a lot of ways because it enables you to play really interesting roles?
Well, I think it's a good break. I mean, I sort of am what I am. I don't regret, I don't much regret not being more handsome or, I think I'm a very odd assortment of characteristics. It's sort of, there's a lot of peculiarities and surprises about my body, my movements, my face, and I've just sort of learned to appreciate that. I'm sort of a surprising person, and I mean, as soon as I'm acting, I'm a surprising person, and I think the trick for an actor is to get to know himself very well, to get to know what his abilities are, what his both his limitations and his capacities are. And I've found that I've been able to sort of expand my horizons all the time. And I think that's just because, almost because I'm kind of an odd, eccentric person in physically and in other ways.
You have a couple of movies coming out?
Mm-hmm. One is called Out Cold, which is a sort of oddball black comedy about two butchers. Terry Garr and Randy Quaid and Bruce McGill and I are in that. It's a murder comedy. And then a very serious father-son drama called Distant Thunder that Paramount is releasing in October. They couldn't be more different, these two movies, true to form.
Right. Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a real pleasure. I especially liked hearing myself.
it was really fun hearing you in those roles, and thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you. My guest has been John Lithgow, who's now starring in Broadway in the play M. Butterfly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Thomas Martinez. He was a member of the neo-Nazi group The Order, but he turned against the group and became an FBI informant. He writes about this in his new book, Brotherhood of Murder. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's been 1 year since the Precinct House burned down at the conclusion of Hill Street Blues. Coming up, I speak with actor Daniel J. Travanti. Hill Street's in syndication, and Travanti, who played Captain Frank Farrillo, has moved on to other roles. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new four-album retrospective of British guitarist Eric Clapton. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews White Mischief, the true story of high life and murder in British colonial Kenya. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Labor strikes in Poland are gaining support despite government efforts to end the walkouts. Officials have declared illegal a steel strike in Krakow involving nearly 20,000 workers. More from the BBC's David Blow.
Over the past 24 hours, there's been a distinct hardening in the attitude being taken towards the strike by the Polish authorities. The management has broken off talks with the strike committee, and a statement by the Krakow public prosecutor declaring the strike illegal and warning that those taking part in it could face criminal charges is reported to have been posted up throughout the plant. A management official has been quoted as saying that he couldn't comment on whether earlier guarantees that no repressive action would be taken against the strikers were still valid, indicating that they might no longer be. And there are reports that attempts have been made to force workers to fill out questionnaires on their attitude towards the strike. Police have also visited the homes of members of the strike committee and of activists of the banned Free Trade Union Solidarity to serve them with summonses from the Krakow prosecutor.
David Blow in Vienna. In Jerusalem today, Arab shopkeepers observed a complete commercial strike. The strike was also observed in the Israeli-occupied territories, where public transportation was at a standstill. The protest was against the recent deportation of 16 Palestinians. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The commercial strike comes at a time when Israeli military authorities have introduced a number of new measures to break the Palestinian uprising. A few days ago, Arab merchants were jailed for failing to open their shops. Today, a new measure was introduced to deter children from participating in demonstrations. According to Israeli radio, parents have had to post bond for children too young to be jailed. Today in Ramallah, a Palestinian was shot dead during a demonstration. In the West Bank city of Hebron, a Palestinian was wounded by an Israeli-appointed bodyguard for Hebron's mayor. Protesters outside his office called for the mayor's resignation. The mayor was appointed by the Israelis. The mayor of the city of Nablus offered his resignation a few weeks ago. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
Rebel leaders arrived in Managua today and resumed peace talks with Nicaraguan government officials. The Contra bargaining position has been weakened by deep divisions within the leadership over how to proceed in the talks. Tensions surfaced last week when Contra political director Adolfo Calero tried to depose military commander Enrique Bermudez. In Managua, Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega said today that he believes a peace agreement can be reached if government and rebel negotiators bargain in good faith. The White House repeated its threat today to veto the trade bill, while the Senate Democratic leadership was warning the president not to veto the bill. Here's Democratic leader Robert Byrd.
This is a good bill. The president has an opportunity to sign a good bill for America, for the working people and the industries of this country. He will be the doctor. He's going to have the patient in his hands. He can kill it. He can ensure its life. The people will know who killed Cock Robin.
The bill has been approved by both houses of Congress, but the Senate vote was not enough to override a veto. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater today said President Reagan wants to work with Congress to develop a bill that would be acceptable. A bill that would be acceptable to the president would not include a provision to require employers to give their workers advance notice of plant closings. The Ford Motor Company reported record earnings today and remains the auto industry's leading moneymaker. First quarter profits rose nearly 9%, totaling more than $1.5 billion. A figure that tops the combined profits of General Motors and Chrysler. Ford's first quarter sales rose 14%. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In some circles, guitarist and singer Eric Clapton is revered as one of the holy men of rock music. Generations of air guitarists have been inspired by his sexy blues licks. A new four-record collection spanning Clapton's 25-year career has just been released, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. From the retrospective called Crossroads, here's Clapton backed by Duane Allman.
I've got the blues. I pack my things. I've got the blues, when I pack my things and go. I guess you don't love me, you love it, Mr. So-and-so.
The Eric Clapton embalmed on Crossroads is a pretty intriguing fellow. When you listen to the music he's made with the Yardbirds, John Mayall's Bluesbreakers, Cream, Blind Faith, Derek and the Dominoes, and as a solo artist, what comes across is Clapton's modesty, his self-effacement. Modesty is a pretty unusual trait in a rock star, and in Clapton's case, it's been pursued to an almost neurotic degree. As a working-class illegitimate child born in England, Clapton was as self-conscious as any artist could be. His intense identification with black American blues musicians led him to feel that he had no personality of his own, that he was destined to be a pure instrument through which the blues might speak. That's an instrumental recorded in 1965 with Clapton on guitar and John Mayall on piano. Already, Clapton's style was set. He approached the blues and subsequently rock as a paradox, something to be played with passionate restraint. The idea was that by suggesting just how much you were holding back, you could fully convey your pain, your joy, your love, your despair. This is heavy stuff, and Clapton has never evinced much of a sense of humor about what he does. This is the limitation placed on whatever claim to greatness he might have. And greatness is what this big collection is all about. That and commerce. That's Sleeping in the Ground, recorded in 1969 by Blind Faith. That's Steve Winwood singing in front of Clapton's guitar. Sleeping in the Ground is one of a number of previously unreleased tracks offered to Eric Clapton fans on Crossroads. The idea of this project was to sum up Clapton's achievement to date, and this is an especially appealing idea to many people right now, since it seems that after a string of mediocre albums in the 80s, Clapton's best, most innovative work is behind him. Thus, he lends himself to the greatest hits packaging. Clapton's followers have known for years that there is an enormous amount of music their hero recorded that never made it onto record. With other rockers, this unreleased stuff is most often a hollow legend, because usually the music hasn't been made public for a good reason. It tends to be junk. In Clapton's case, however, there are a few new songs on Crossroads that can stand with the strongest music of his career. Take, for example, this one. It's called Laudy Mama. Clapton recorded it in 1966 with Cream, the trio he led with bassist Jack Bruce and drummer Ginger Baker.
We'll be right back. Crossroads doesn't, after all of its 73 songs have been heard, hold up as the definitive best of Eric Clapton. For example, right off the top of my ears, I can hear that producer Bill Levinson left off the best music from Clapton's finest latter-day album, Money and Cigarettes. And audiophiles all over the country will be arguing about whether the new remixed, remastered version of Clapton's most famous single work, Layla, is an improvement or a desecration of the original. What it comes down to is, if you've got the money for this expensive archival material, you'll probably enjoy it. But if you pull out that old copy of the Derek and the Dominoes album, the one you wrote your name on with magic marker, the one with cat hair in the grooves, you'll catch as much of the genius of this modest man as is revealed here.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's the remixed version of Layla, and this is Fresh Air. Daniel J. Travanti played Captain Frank Farillo for 7 years on Hill Street Blues. The captain did his best to keep his cops honest and to resist the self-serving orders from his superiors.
You don't think the press and the public are going to know exactly what you're trying to do?
And what's that, Farillo? Divert attention from a tragic police involvement? Avoid a major lawsuit against the city?
You're making a lot of uninformed assumptions there, Frank.
Farillo became the model of a decent and fair authority figure, and that's what Hill Street fans associate Travanti's face and voice with. But Hill Street is over, and Travanti is taking on other roles. In the new film Midnight Crossing, he stars opposite Faye Dunaway. He plays the heavy, setting up his wife and friends for a cruise that will end in a double cross.
So, let's get down to business.
Helen and I are going to have our 20th anniversary in August.
That's great.
And I want to do something real special. And I want to charter your boat and have the four of us sail it to Grand Bahama. Well, what do you think?
Well,
I'm flattered, but I haven't been on that boat in...
Helen, come on. You remember back at the base? I always took my leaves on a boat, just the two of us. Alexa said you'd charter out for $3,000 a week.
Uh-huh. Morley?
Yeah. I know you can use the money because I know what kind of commission she's been pulling down lately. So, I guess it's a go.
In Hill Street, you always played a very honorable and fair man. Did you want in this new movie to take on a role that would change that image?
There's nothing to change. I'm an actor. It's the only thing I ever claimed to be. Plenty of people know that. Not enough yet, but plenty do.
What did you like about this role?
Something I hadn't done before. I'd never played Morley Barton from South Florida, who looked like that and moved like that and talked like that and said those things.
Is this your first theatrical feature film?
No. Nope. It's my fourth.
Which others have you been in?
I don't mention them.
Oh,
I have to tell the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences because I have to in order to join. They're not bad, mind you. They were just made before anybody knew who I was.
Well, they're probably not going to be released if they were made back
They've
then,
been,
right?
Oh, you mean released again?
Uh-huh.
Oh, they were released and did very well, in fact, all three of them.
Oh, I see. So why don't we know that you're in them?
Because many actors labor in obscurity for many years in some cases and then are suddenly found, you know?
So should I interpret this as that you're kind of embarrassed by those movies?
I'm not embarrassed at all. I'm not embarrassed by anything I've ever done. I've not always been satisfied With most of it, in fact, I've not been satisfied, especially on film or tape. But that's because I have very high standards.
You know, for a long time, I think in the film world that there had been reluctance in the past to cast someone who was really identified with one particular character.
No, I don't think
But I think that that's changed.
I don't think that's the way it works. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that you identify with one character necessarily. It's just that you were in television. Why that's so, I do not know. If you know the answer, Terry, I'd like to know. I don't think anybody's ever figured that out.
You know, I'm sure you think of Hill Street Blues as your past. But
you bet.
It's in a way still in my present since I'm watching reruns and syndication every night.
That's fine for you. That's, right. I'm happy for you. Will you be happy for me?
Well, I guess, you know, I figure financially it's an actor's dream to have something that's in syndication. But how do you feel about that still being on?
It's not as much money as you think.
No kidding, really?
Not nearly. Mm-hmm. Nope. How do I feel about what?
About it still being on, because it means you're still in the mind of the viewing public like myself, that you're still going to be associated with Hill Street even though it's...
It's all right to be associated with it, as long as people understand that it's only one portion of my entire body of work.
Would you mind if I asked you a couple of questions about the series?
Go ahead and try me.
Okay. The character that you played, Captain Farrillo, was always in control.
Oh, him.
Yeah, always.
Not always.
Always knew, well, usually knew how to behave, was usually decisive, usually had a sense of gravity about
him.
Yes,
he had to be in order for that whole thing to work, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I was wondering if you felt you had those characteristics of decisiveness and gravity.
Sometimes, but I'm much crazier than he is. A couple of the biggest laughs my friends got were when they heard that I was going to be playing a guy in a three-piece suit who was quiet. And still. You still not bouncing off walls, careening around corners, running up and down stairs when you should be walking. Yeah, that's acting, folks. That was all acting. Nice acting. I didn't mind it at all.
Well, you really get to live with a character when you do it for that long.
No, I would show up in my shorts and tank top and T-shirts and sneakers and jeans and whatever other casual wear, go into my dressing room, turn around three times, and emerge Farrillo Man. And when I went home at the end of the day, I just took him off and I went home.
I'll tell you, an impression that I'm getting is not true of you. There are some actors who... seem to feel kind of empty when they don't have a role, that they really need to have a role to become themselves in some way?
No, I don't feel empty. I just think that I will never work again like all other actors,
I admit.
I admit it. No, let's put it this way. I think that I will never work again in a role which I really, really want to play. I could work from now until I die. When I leave the studio, I could make one phone call and the machinery would begin to turn, and I could go do television show after television show after television show after television movie after series after movie after movie after movie forever and get filthy, damned rich and be dead. Because I hate them. They're crap, most of them, and they always have been crap. And most of what I did before Hill Street was junk.
Were you glad that the Hill Street series ended when
Boy,
it did?
Boy, you bet. Uh-huh. Whoa, did you hear hesitation at all in my response?
I can't say that I did.
I couldn't wait. Thank you very much. We did all we could for each other. We knocked our brains out. Thank you very much. I'm forever grateful. Next.
You know, I have to tell you, a few years ago, I saw you on a Mod Squad rerun. I'm pretty sure it was Mod Squad.
I did three of those, I think.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, this was a few summers ago. Mm. I said, if I remember correctly, you were a Southern punk type. Mm. Is that right?
Yes, I played many, many roles. Now you know what's happening? I'm playing the same roles, only I'm somewhat known, and now they're applauding the work, some people. It's the same work. But yes, I've run the gamut. I've played every kind of wimp and tough guy and good old boy and nasty rapist, demented murderer, intelligent professor, swashbuckler, all kinds of things. Now I'm just going to do it all again while people are really noticing for a lot more money.
You sound a little bit resentful, I have to say.
You misread me entirely.
Do I? Okay.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? No, I'm the most positive guy you'll ever talk to.
All right.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about something that's been written about you?
Mm.
I think most of the stories I've read about you have mentioned that you used to have a drinking problem, mm-hmm. which and you stopped drinking, I think, in the early 70s. Does it bother you that that's public, or is that something you just assume
no,
would be public?
No, I made it public because I couldn't go around talking all around it for the rest of my life once they knew who I was. So I had to make a choice. I didn't know the thing to do. There is no textbook for this. I talked about it, let it be known, that therefore nobody could sneak up on me and say, aha, we found out something about you that you don't want to talk about. I'd already talked about it. And then I had to figure out when to stop talking about it, and it seems to be working out.
So you feel like you've stopped talking about it, and you'd rather not talk about it.
Get that impression?
Right. Okay.
I'll talk to you privately forever about it.
I'm going to just ask you one more Hill Street question. Mm. There was an episode in Hill Street, actually a couple of episodes, where an actor who's going to play a policeman wants to come into the precinct and watch the policeman at work.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right? Mm-hmm. And of course...
nice built-in triple irony.
Right. Because, you know, in the program, the captain really resents it, and of course all the men really resent it.
And we were all saying, boy, listen, look what our guys have done here now.
Right, of
here
course.
Here we are, actors being policemen, faking it, objecting to an actor wanting to fake being a policeman. Yeah, good.
Exactly. Now, were you in the position of having to go into a precinct and understudy them?
No. But I did. I met them inevitably because they liked us. No, of course not. I'm an actor. I can do anything. I have an imagination. I have an instinct. And I've lived a good long time, and I've read a lot of books and seen a lot of movies and listened to a lot of radio shows. So I can do anything.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Daniel J. Travanti's new movie, Midnight Crossing, opens next month. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we'll have the latest on the labor unrest in Poland. It's now in its third day, and some 8,000 steelworkers are out on strike. Also, a report on an AIDS bill that's now on the floor of the Senate. And we look in on Archie Harrison, who has AIDS. You might remember we've been following his progress for over a year now, actually. And Archie, he's been taking the drug AZT.
How's his health now?
Well, he's been doing pretty well over the last year, but recently he was hospitalized for painful ulcers of the esophagus. It really made it hard for him to swallow or drink. He's out of the hospital now. He's feeling better, but he's still very weak and thin.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. White Mischief is a new film about decadence in the ruling class during the decline of British colonialism in Africa. It's based on a 1982 novel of the same name by James Fox, and it stars Greta Scacchi and Charles Dance. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Greta Scacchi is a heavenly-looking actress who also looks like hell. She's one of the great screen beauties of the moment, and yet, despite her peaches and cream skin and her sumptuous figure, she often exudes the world-weary aura of someone who's seen too much high life in too little time. There are bags under her luminous eyes, and her jaw often sags. In short, she's perfectly cast in a movie about British aristocrats furiously burning their candles at both ends. White Mischief is based on the true story of Joss Hay, the Earl of Errol, who was murdered in Kenya during World War II. The setting is the notorious colony of Happy Valley near Nairobi, where a gaggle of Britain's richest pleasure seekers holed up during the war to escape from the dreary responsibilities of blitz-ridden London. In Happy Valley, they set up their own divinely decadent dream world, swapping drugs and wives and vicious gossip with a freedom they seldom enjoyed at home, and setting up their vast coffee and cattle ranches as if they were proper Berkshire estates. Greta Scacchi plays the new girl in town, the wife of the aging and unpopular plutocrat Jock Broughton, who's played coldly but with towering authority by Joss Ackland. No sooner does the new Mrs. Broughton arrive in Kenya than she takes up with the scandalous Lord Errol, played by jaunty Charles Dance. Eventually, of course, her husband discovers that he's been cuckolded, and he storms into a local nightclub to confront her and Lord Errol.
I'm going home. You coming?
No, it's too early. I'll stay at the club tonight.
The club? Why?
I don't know how late I'll be.
Would you bring Diana home tonight?
Well, yes, if she wants me to.
As a friend, Joss, bring her home.
Have you asked her?
I'm asking you.
Well, I'm sorry, John. Can't do that.
Why not?
Because she's spending the night with me.
One of the flavors I most enjoy on screen is smirky British naughtiness. And for a while, White Mischief lays on the decadence with just the right air of feigned indifference masking goggle-eyed disbelief. The exceedingly fey Sarah Miles keeps showing up wearing a boa around her neck. Not the feather kind, the snake kind. And people drift languidly in and out, brandishing syringes and dropping savage bon mots. Unfortunately, this stuff can't sustain a whole movie, and the filmmakers, writer-director Michael Radford and his co-writer Jonathan Gems, realize it. But when they try to get serious by turning the romance between Mrs. Broughton and Lord Errol into a great and passionate love, it won't wash. The movie's mocking tone has already trivialized the characters so much that they seem incapable of any emotion more urgent than the longing for a dry martini. They're silly people. And the more the movie tries to stir us to care deeply about them, the more phony and tiresome it seems. And there's one more problem. You might call it the dynasty factor. By now, American audiences could easily find the hyped-up immorality in a movie like White Mischief rather tepid compared to what TV soap operas dish out every day. It's not White Mischief's fault, but we may now be so jaded that watching the jaded has lost its tiny thrill.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with syndicated political cartoonist Tony Auth. Jules Pfeiffer says Auth's cartoons are not just funny, they have true political content. Auth's new collection is titled Lost in Space, The Reagan Years. Also, New Orleans pianist and singer Mac Rebenack will be back for the last of his weekly performances. Up to now, he's paid homage to other New Orleans musicians, but this time he'll play his own music. He calls it homegrown Dr. John the Night Tripper music. And critic at large Laurie Stone will review Without You, I'm Nothing, the off-Broadway one-woman show by comic Sandra Bernhardt. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.